tonight on PBS News Weekend. Ahead of tonight's 96th Annual Academy Awards, the role and recognition of women both in front of and behind the camera. Then, a new book re-examines the relationship between Saddam Hussein and the U.S. across four administrations.
Saddam's contribution to the origins of the war has been missing from our own reckoning. And for once, we have the opportunity with these new materials to really expand our sense of where this tragedy came from.
And what's behind the recent push for legislation that gives fetuses the legal rights of a person? Good evening. I'm Laura Barone Lopez. John Yang is away. Today, talks aimed at securing a six-week ceasefire in Gaza remain stalled as efforts to increase aid deliveries by sea moved ahead at a crawling pace. A U.S. Army ship full of equipment to build a temporary pier off Gaza's coast for delivering aid is en route to the Mediterranean. Construction of the pier is expected to take weeks. Another ship full of aid is still waiting in Cyprus. As the civilian death toll in Gaza climbs, President Biden stepped up his public criticism of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in an interview on MSNBC.
He must pay more attention to the innocent lives being lost as a consequence of the actions taken. He's hurting, in my view, he's hurting Israel more than helping Israel by making the rest of the world, it's contrary to what Israel stands for.
Biden also said an Israeli military operation into the southern city of Rafah would cross a red line, but added that the U.S. would continue sending weapons shipments to Israel. Alabama Senator Katie Britt responded to criticisms today about a misleading story she told in her Republican response to President Biden's State of the Union address. In criticizing Biden's border policies, Britt talked about meeting a woman who had been sex trafficked at age 12. In reality, the trafficking occurred outside of the U.S. decades ago. Britt appeared on Fox News Sunday.
To be clear, the story that you relate is not something that's happened under the Biden administration, that particular person.
I very clearly said I spoke to a woman who told me about when she was trafficked when she was 12. So I didn't say a teenager. I didn't say a young woman, a grown woman, a woman when she was trafficked when she was 12.
Senator Britt's office confirmed on Saturday that she was speaking about a woman who had been sexually abused in Mexico from 2004 to 2008. And in Haiti, the U.S. military airlifted non-essential embassy personnel out of the capital, Port-au-Prince, overnight and added U.S. forces to bolster security as escalating gang violence threatens to bring down the government. The Caribbean nation is under a state of emergency. Thousands of Haitians have been forced from their homes in the unrest, and efforts to assemble a foreign armed force to aid Haitian police have been unsuccessful so far. Still to come on PBS News Weekend, a new examination of the relationship between the U.S. and Saddam Hussein, and the conservative push to give fetuses legal rights.
This is PBS News Weekend from WETA Studios in Washington, home of the PBS NewsHour, weeknights on PBS.
Tonight's 96th Academy Awards will honor the most acclaimed films of 2023, a year that could be considered a milestone for women in film. Women filmmakers set a record in the Best Picture category, including Greta Gerwig's Barbie, which is the highest-grossing film ever directed by a woman. But the past year, punctuated by months of strikes in Hollywood, also highlighted the ongoing struggles in diversity, equal pay, and equal opportunities for women. Rebecca Sun is senior editor of Diversity and Inclusion for The Hollywood Reporter. Rebecca, this year, a record-breaking three films directed by women are nominated for Best Picture. Is this a sign of progress or an outlier?
I think it's a sign of progress, but with a huge caveat. It is a sign of progress that people are recognizing movies directed by women as worthy of Best Picture nominations. However, it must be noted that only one of those women was nominated herself for Best Director. And so that's where the big caveat comes in. People are loving the overall result and not really giving credit to the person who is most responsible for that success.
Speaking of these directors, last year, no female directors were nominated for Best Director. This year, we have one, Justine Triet, for directing Anatomy of a Fall. What does that say about the recognition of women in major roles in Hollywood?
I think what that says is that we have not yet reached a point of equilibrium or status quo. You're still dependent on that specific crop of films year to year. You're still dependent on a number of factors. We're not at a point where, just like with men, you can say, wow, this year, you know, four or five men were nominated for director. You don't say things like that because it's sort of a given. We're still seeing that this is vastly the exception and not the rule.
A recent report out of UCLA found that films with diverse casts received the highest median global box office earnings across last year's top films. And audiences of color flocked to opening weekends for 14 out of the top 20 films. Is Hollywood responding to this in any way?
Not in a way that is commensurate to what we're seeing. It's been known for years and years that movie-going audiences, in other words, the American population, is growing more racially diverse. And yet I do think that conventional wisdom in Hollywood, the decisions made by those who are at the very top, they still are thinking of white audiences as sort of the norm, and that anything that appeals to everybody else as niche. And so whenever they make a film that's quote-unquote targeted towards quote-unquote diverse audiences, that is seen as a niche film and not a wide four-quadrant release. So there is still quite a ways to go, despite what the audiences are saying.
Films like Barbie and The Little Mermaid, which both had female leads, were among the top 10 highest grossing films last year. But does that mean that that type of success actually translates into more opportunities for women?
I think it has the potential to translate, but only if you're taking the correct takeaway messages. For example, when Barbie hit huge on opening weekend, there were a few think pieces initially that said, wow, you know, this means that Hollywood should make more movies about toys, not more movies that are driven by and about women. And so it really, really does depend on, you know, what you believe is the moral of the story. I mean, I think with Barbie and The Little Mermaid, are you just saying that, like, oh, I guess women are going to the movies now? Or are you saying, I guess everybody likes seeing movies about female characters? Those are two completely different takeaway statements.
What about unequal pay? Actress Taraji P. Henson, who's in the Oscar-nominated film The Color Purple, spoke out during the film's press tour about how women, and especially Black women, are treated in Hollywood. And essentially, in Hollywood, women are paid fractions of what their male counterparts make. How pervasive is that problem?
That problem is as pervasive in Hollywood as it is in every other industry in this society. You know, I think that it's the only difference is that the entertainment industry is a lot more visible. But still, what Taraji P. Henson is talking about is she's not comparing her salary to that of teachers who are chronically underpaid and part of a different conversation. She's talking about her salary compared to men who have had a commensurate level of experience and a commensurate level of accomplishment in the industry. When you look at that, the numbers do not lie. Women in Hollywood, including famous women in Hollywood, are still underpaid compared to men. And that is exacerbated even further when you're talking about women of color.
Before we let you go, were there any films this year directed by women, produced by women, or that had female leads that went under the radar but that are worth watching?
This is a tricky one because it's not exactly completely under the radar. Celine Song's Past Lives, she's a first-time filmmaker. She has an extensive playwriting background. It's just a subtle piece of work. It's really beautiful. It's a small, quiet movie. It has been nominated for Best Picture. It might take a while for people to discover, and so I hope they do sooner than later.
Rebecca Sun of The Hollywood Reporter, thank you for your time.
Thank you so much.
In 2003, the U.S. invasion of Iraq was based on the allegation that the country's longtime dictator, Saddam Hussein, had weapons of mass destruction. The failure to find these weapons prompted intense scrutiny of the decision to go to war over two decades ago. In his new book, author Steve Call pored over hundreds of audio tapes and transcripts, many previously unreleased, of Saddam Hussein's internal meetings to uncover his view on the tumultuous relationship with the United States. Nick Schiffer Schifrin recently sat down with Call.
The U.S. relationship with Saddam Hussein evolved dramatically across the decades, from the 1980s, when the U.S. aided his regime, to the 90s, when the U.S. sought to contain him and dismantle his program of weapons of mass destruction. And, of course, after 9/11, the U.S. invasion and his death in 2006. Using previously unreleased materials, the Achilles trap, Saddam Hussein, the CIA, and the origins of America's invasion of Iraq tells the story of how Saddam Hussein and four successive U.S. administrations repeatedly misinterpreted each other. The author is Steve Call. Steve Call, thank you very much. You write that this book, in part, is about the U.S. failure to comprehend Saddam Hussein, and you write that U.S. thinking was often wrong, distorted, and incomplete. How so?
Well, Saddam's motives confounded us. They also confounded many of his own generals and his neighbors, but he took actions that just didn't fit into Western logic and analysis. And so the U.S., particularly after the war to expel him from Kuwait, just assumed the worst. And in fact, he was making very complicated decisions on the basis of a calculation that we didn't really understand.
And that was mutual. You write how Saddam Hussein misinterpreted and had misaligned perceptions about what the CIA was doing. How so?
Well, he saw the CIA as omniscient, and he had long experience with their involvement in changes of government in Iraq, and he saw them around every corner and thought, for example, that they knew that he didn't have weapons of mass destruction. And so he interpreted the accusation that he did as just a game. And his comments to his comrades when he was talking to them in private was, there's no reason for us to play this game. We are not going to be rewarded by being honest or cooperative, so let's maintain our pride and defy them.
You document how the Reagan administration decided to help him, writing at one point that by 1983, it had lashed itself to an ambitious dictator. How did that effort go, and how did Saddam Hussein's own perception of U.S. assistance evolve?
Well, our objective was to help him avoid losing the war he had started with Iran. And we feared that he might, and that Ayatollah Khomeini would expand the Iranian revolution into Baghdad. So we started providing him with secret intelligence to give him a military advantage. He always regarded this help with suspicion, and he thought we were playing a double game. And we assured him for several years that he was wrong. And then in 1986,
he wasn't wrong.
And the Iran-Contra scandal demonstrated that, at least for a short time, the Reagan administration had played both sides. And there are these wonderful tapes after the scandal is revealed where he says to his comrades, I told you so. And what's important about it is that this conviction that there was a conspiracy between the United States, Israel, and Iran against him persisted well into the 90s. And so later, as he's talking to his colleagues about whether to cooperate, he refers back to Iran-Contra and says, just remember, what was revealed then remains the case now, and so we should be careful.
How did Saddam Hussein undergo what you describe as the, quote, stunning transformation from tenuous American ally to mortal enemy?
By invading and occupying Kuwait, an innocent neighbor with no defenses, that a country he decided essentially in the aftermath of his very expensive war with Iran, that he needed Kuwait's wealth to reconstruct Iraq. And he ended up in a dispute with the Kuwaiti royal family and then decided basically to sack the country. Of course, George H.W. Bush organized an international military coalition to successfully expel him from Kuwait, but he survived in power. And that became the unfinished business of the 1990s that George W. Bush inherited on 9/11.
What did you discover about why Saddam Hussein essentially destroyed his weapons of mass destruction program after the Gulf War, but then was reluctant to allow UN weapons inspectors to be able to confirm that fact?
In the summer of 1991, he more or less secretly destroyed his chemical and biological stocks and the infrastructure of his nuclear weapons program. But then he failed to keep any records. He failed to tell the truth about what he had done. He lied about the history of the program, and he didn't really come clean for 4 or 5 years, creating the impression that he was hiding a secret weapons program. And that uncertainty persisted right through to the end. Why? Partly, I think he didn't want to appear weak in front of his enemies. He didn't want to appear weak in front of his own generals because he feared a coup attempt. He didn't want to be humiliated, and he also concluded that honesty wouldn't pay. And about this, he might be right, because as Madeleine Albright announced in 1997, the real underlying policy of the sanctions he was trying to escape was not just his disarmament, but his replacement.
The third era that you write about, of course, is after 9/11. And you point out in the days after 9/11, he made no attempt to separate himself from Osama bin Laden and said publicly the U.S., quote, is reaping the thorns its leaders have planted. Explain that.
He was oblivious to his own vulnerability after 9/11. And like a lot of people in the Arab world, he thought that the United States deserved a little bit of taste of the kind of rebound of its foreign policy. And so he became this kind of pundit in his meetings with his own cabinet and with visitors, continually talking about America's failures in the world and the consequences of 9/11. At the same time, he really was slow to pick up on the possibility that he would be targeted in retaliation for 9/11. He would say, of course, I had nothing to do with Osama bin Laden. I'm against Islamists of that type. But he didn't recognize that he was already in the crosshairs.
And finally, this is not about Ukraine, about the Middle East. It's a different topic than you've written about before. Why this topic? Why this book?
Well, I hope that enough time has passed that this momentous event in American post-Cold War life, the Iraq War, probably the biggest pivot point that we experienced as a nation after the fall of the Berlin Wall, that we could think in a different and larger way about its origins, because Saddam's contribution to the origins of the war has been missing from our own reckoning. And for once, we have the opportunity with these new materials to really expand our sense of where this tragedy came from.
The book is called The Achilles Trap, Saddam Hussein, the CIA, and the Origins of America's Invasion of Iraq. Steve Call, thank you very much.
Nick, great to be with you.
Last month, the all-Republican Alabama Supreme Court ruled that embryos created using in vitro fertilization are legally children and have what's known as personhood. The decision caused clinics across the state to halt all services, fearing potential prosecution for destroyed embryos. After weeks of backlash, Republican Alabama Governor Kay Ivey signed a bill on Wednesday that gives IVF providers and patients immunity from criminal charges. But the new legislation did not clarify whether frozen embryos will still have the same rights as people. Recently, John Yang spoke to Julie F. Kay, a human rights attorney who defends reproductive rights in cases around the world.
Julie, this ruling in Alabama was hailed by many in the anti-abortion movement, but then it was quickly followed by lawmakers in Alabama, many of them opponents of abortion, pressing for legislation that would protect in vitro fertilization from the effects of this ruling. What does that say about the approach or the attitude of the anti-abortion movement toward this issue?
Well, what it says is this is an election year, and they realize that an anti-abortion position is wildly unpopular with voters. About 70% of the country right now supports the Roe versus Wade framework. And as we've seen in individual lives, abortion is a key health care issue for many women and families. So some of these legislators are trying to kind of peel off, who's deserving of reproductive health care by saying that IVF, yes, that's a good thing, but if you're going to make decisions about abortion or contraception or even miscarriage management, we're going to take that decision away from you and put it in the hands of anti-abortion folks and politicians.
To make sure that everyone understands this issue, explain how fetal personhood affects in vitro fertilization and other reproductive health treatments.
Fetal personhood is kind of what we've seen in other countries such as Ireland that had a constitutional provision that equated the unborn with the mother or a pregnant person. And really what it does is try to hold a person's life at the same level as something that is either a fertilized egg or even before implantation and an embryo. And this is really about control. It's about who gets to decide whether, when, and with whom somebody gets to have a child or not. So what we're seeing here is really an attempt to broaden the anti-abortion position to control not just abortion, but also contraception, IVF, and a whole host of some of the most fundamental human rights decisions that women make.
These other states that we mentioned that have similar laws, do they have protections or carve-outs for IVF and other reproductive health issues?
The issue of whether IVF is banned or not is really new. It's not something that is that unexpected to those of us who have been working in the field for a long time, but it's kind of come upon us like gangbusters in the post-Roe landscape. And, you know, how different states handle this, both in the legislative arena as well as what public officials are saying as far as aiding and abetting of abortion and criminalization, how women get treated in fertility clinics or in emergency rooms or in reproductive health care generally, is really unknown right now. And what we are seeing is that more and more women are choosing to have medication abortions than ever before. Right now, that's the most popular method of abortion in this country. And telemedicine, virtual visits with your provider, are up to about 1/5 of the abortions in this country. So we're seeing this real uptick in people taking charge of their own medical decision-making and abortion rights through this new and safe method of abortion, at the same time as anti-abortion state officials are really expanding more and more every day what they're trying to do to control reproductive rights in this country.
You talk about those efforts. You say this has come on like gangbusters since Roe was overturned. What do you think the effect is going to be in other states that tend to not favor abortion, to oppose abortion rights?
Well, I think we're going to see some copycats of anti-abortion politicians and state officials really fervently trying to either erase access to IVF, stem cell research, contraceptives, a whole host of things. Well, at the same time, the anti-abortion movement is split because some opponents of abortion wouldn't go that far, or if they would go that far, they're not going to do it in an election year. We've seen states trying to criminalize mifepristone, which is the abortion and miscarriage management medication. And overall, it's become a political football because they don't have the majority of Americans who want to ban abortion rights. So they're doing what they can through conservative courts, through judicial maneuvers, and through messing with ballot initiatives to really take away the rights that people want.
Julie F. Kaye, human rights attorney, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And that's our program for tonight. I'm Laura Barone-Lopez. For all of my colleagues, thanks for joining us.